Okay, welcome to Discovery 2, Module 5. And this morning is when we start getting into the heavy bits of initial router configuration. And we're going to talk about how you set up an integrated services router. And we're going to talk about the initial steps used in configuring the integrated services router. And we're going to talk about the things that you will initially want to set up if your business is financial enough to be able to source Cisco routers, or you're an aspiring Cisco student that goes and buys one. Just a progress report on the remote bundle. We have the first virtual machine installed on Bundle Box 1. So we're actually looking at getting the remote bundle operational sooner rather than later, except of course perhaps when I have nicked the extender cable off the bundle box, which I currently have, to put my mobile internet 3 dongle above the level of my clunky 17-inch CRT monitor. Okay, now, has anybody got any questions so far? And I don't think they do, but you don't have any questions so far, do you, Grace? You're the only one on at the moment.
I'm all right, thank you.
Oh, I didn't ask you how you were, just asked you whether you had any questions.
Well, yeah, I don't, if that's what I was meaning.
Excellent. Wonderful. Okay, Module 5, we are talking about the initial configuration of an integrated services router. An integrated services router being a router that is defined as a router with integrated services. No, it's got a switch, it has a router, it sometimes has a wireless access point, and it has connectivity options to external network devices. Those connectivity options include ADSL, SHDSL, ISDN, serial ports, synchronous serial ports, in some cases asynchronous ports, ISDN, and in some models cable router functionality. So these are sort of external connectivity options. You can either get an integrated services router, which is good for small businesses. So what you can do is you can plug in up to 4 PCs into the onboard switch. Somebody's just walked in. Okay. Although usually you need more switch ports than 4. I've yet to see too many small businesses with 4 computers or less that want to use the Cisco router unless they're particularly security conscious. So you usually hook in other switches such as the 2960 and the 2940. Most of the businesses that I deal with don't buy Cisco gear, they buy Linksys gear because it's significantly cheaper. Now, whilst I wouldn't suggest that you cut price for security, there are sometimes budgetary considerations, which means that you can't afford the incredibly expensive support contracts or the incredibly expensive router hardware. To give you some idea, your average ADSL modem, for example, in Australia, retails for about $60 to maybe $250, and I think the Cisco 876 is $970. So yeah, we'll all run out and buy one of those. There are, however, cases where it's ISP managed, and that is a good thing when the ISP actually leases you the router and you pay them a fee to look after it and stuff. If you're working for one of these ISPs that's responsible for pre-configuring these integrated services routers, this chapter skill set is very important. Now, we're all going to have a groan here, but the first thing you're going to find about this Cisco integrated services router is the first thing we do for security is turn off the web interface. Any idea why?
Because it's very easy to access the web interface if you know how to do it. It's just the default, and you can very easily go in and mess with the router.
That is partially true. The actual reason is that the web interface serves its pages up over HTTP, and it is possible for other network users to sniff out the administrative passwords by running a network sniffer and grabbing the passwords as you configure the router with the web interface. That is less of a problem if you're using switches and stuff, because switches do tend to isolate the packets to the specific segments. But it is something that's worth considering. The other dangerous thing is if you are administering the router via a web interface over the internet, which is a bad idea, you would be sending your passwords in the clear over the big wide internet, and who knows who's watching which packets and stuff. A standard method, and I would not condone the following behavior, a standard method of stealing users' usernames and passwords used to be sniffing traffic on a cable connection, because cable is a shared medium, and you could actually look for traffic to the POP server on port 110 and steal all of the usernames and passwords for the people that lived on your block. Okie dokie. The other thing is you're right, it is easy to go in and mess around with the router and mess things up. Also, the web interface doesn't allow you to configure every aspect of the router. It only allows you to configure some of the most common ones. It's also worth mentioning that if you are running over low bandwidth connections such as modem links, or, yes, you're all going to go, ha-ha, who uses modems these days? You'd be surprised. Mobile phone connections, you might be administering it from an iPhone or a pocket PC or something like that. The text interface is exceedingly low bandwidth and is very snappy and performs very quickly over even the worst connections. It's possible to administer a router with a 9,600 bits per second connection to it, through some very crummy network conditions. And sometimes you are in crummy network conditions, for example, if you're using the wireless at a business or something that everybody else is using, or you're using the motel internet and it's overloaded with everybody else surfing the net or something, it can be quite difficult to get packets out on that particular medium. Okie dokie. Don't think we've got any questions yet, have we? I don't think I've said anything too complicated.
No.
Excellent. All right. The iOS is the Cisco operating system. It is Internet Operating System is what iOS stands for, and it is the compiled image that runs inside the Cisco router. It is an operating system in its own right. It runs on Cisco's proprietary hardware, or in a whole stack of Cisco emulators, which I don't know how... actually, owning the emulator isn't illegal, but owning the iOS images without a license can be legal. Be warned that upgrades to the iOS can actually cost more than your router is worth. So you want to make sure that you are you budget for that, and that you either buy a support contract or an upgrade contract, otherwise you can't get new versions of the iOS. I think they will roll out security patches to everybody, regardless of which iOS version you've got, if they possibly can, provided that the version is still supported. However, they don't roll out new features, so if you're looking for something like IPv6 support and stuff, it's worth having the iOS contract to keep those up to date. The iOS comes in a whole stack of flavors. You've basically got IP base image, which has got the least number of features, and then you've got various add-ins such as voice over IP, or IP telephony, I should say, VPN, advanced routing, wireless, advanced networking, and all sorts of other things. You can tell which model of the iOS you're looking at by looking at the file name. There's two letters that tell you what sort of iOS image it is, and then you look up the table on the Cisco website and it'll tell you which one you've got. The security image adds VPN and firewall, and I think it's more expensive, so you probably want to buy that with your router by default rather than just getting the cheap one. Make sure you know which image you have, before you're trying to configure the ISR, because if it doesn't have the features in that you would like to use, you're not going to be able to configure those features. If you thought Microsoft was bad with its 12 different versions of Windows XP, welcome to Cisco. Good morning, Satish.
Very good morning.
Good morning, Satish.
Just be aware, we are using mobile internet this morning and our signal will break up. Our regular internet is back. Okay, when you configure the ISR, which is where we're up to. When setting up the ISR, you will need the following. Number 2 Phillips screwdriver. Okay, that's a number 2 Phillips. And Phillips, just in case you don't know, they're labelled from 0 up to about... well, you can actually get 00 and 000, but 0 is sort of the smallest one, and then you go up to 3 or 4 or 5, and the 5 one is sort of the ones you use for taking the Phillips head screws out of beds. It's sort of about quarter of an inch across. And we should all know that a Phillips head screwdriver is the star-shaped one, whereas a flat-bladed screwdriver is the flat one. And so you... number 2 Phillips, and some optional cable ties. Now, I would just like to digress here briefly and suggest that whilst cable ties are a good idea and that they are an excellent way of keeping your cables, quote, tidy and organized, quote, it can be very annoying when you have technicians that tie everything up with use-once cable ties and you've got to undo 12 cable ties with a set of side cutters before you can even get at the power cable. So everything in moderation, people. There have been some technicians that I would have liked to have had some serious words with because they've put cable ties on the cables and pulled them so tight that not only have they cut into the insulation, but it becomes exceedingly difficult to slice them off with some side cutters. And if you're not careful, you'll slice your fingers off while you're doing it. So that hasn't happened to me, luckily. Touch wood. But yeah, just be aware of that. Also, and this is more relevant to ITE 1, your computer gets very unhappy if the cable ties that you put on the cables are still too long and one gets stuck in the fan. They can actually break fan blades off. And whilst that sort of makes an interesting noise, that's the end of your CPU fan. So careful with the cable ties. Okay. PC running terminal emulation software. The notes recommend HyperTerminal. I recommend UTF-8 TerraTerm Pro with the JAWS script, which is up on www.qcat.org in the extras folder. There is actually a newer version of TerraTerm out than the one that's up on the QCAT site, which is 4.63, and I will be downloading that and upgrading the site today to have the newest, latest, greatest version. But if you Google for TerraTerm Pro Terminal Emulator, you will find it, and you want version 4.6x. That's a Japanese SourceForge site in English. So that's all good. If you haven't got and installed and configured your copy of TerraTerm, may I strongly suggest that you do it before next week? If so, or do it early next week, because you will start using TerraTerm soon for your labs. It is important that you install TerraTerm, it is important that you copy the JAWS script into the correct folder, and it is important that you compile the JAWS script and configure the settings inside of JAWS correctly, inside of TerraTerm correctly, to change the cursor shape to horizontal or vertical line and to set the right number of screen rows and stuff. That is all covered in the setting up TerraTerm document, which I will refer you all to. Otherwise, students can ask me for some assistance and I'll point you back at the document, and then if that still doesn't work, then you can ask me for some assistance and I'll help you set it up. Has anybody got TerraTerm installed and running and talking yet? Does it, you know, can you log into stuff and it'll talk? Okay, you can have a cyber lollipop. Geraldine's got a bag of them over there. Okay.
Why, thank you.
The other thing you'll need to use is you'll need the cables for the LAN, the WAN, and the telephone interfaces if you're using them. Now, you'd be surprised how many people don't have the right cables. Does anybody remember when they used to sell printers without the USB A to B cable, and you'd get this printer home and you wouldn't have a cable to hook it to your computer?
Never seen one like that.
Canon used to be a big one to do it in sort of the late 90s. They just never used to put the USB cable in because it was assumed that everybody would use the parallel port on the printer. But make sure you have the correct cables and the correct cables that you need for the job, so that you have the correct phone cables, that they're long enough, they have the right connectors on them, the retaining lugs or the tunkers haven't broken off them, and that the cables work. Because that can be an interesting fault to try and diagnose if some of your cables are flaky. Okay, you can read the quick start guides. That's probably not a bad idea. They are available from the Cisco website. And recently there was an email sent out about some excellent resources that you could use to choose your Cisco router product that you wanted, and I believe there were quick start guides in those resources as well. Okay, here's the step-by-step process of powering up an ISR. Now, I'd just like to point out here, people, that turning the power switch on doesn't come till about step 5 or 6, so do the first 4 steps first, okay? You'll really save yourself a lot of time. 1. Securely mount and ground the device chassis or case. That's assuming that the case is made of metal. If it's made of plastic, you don't need to ground it, okay? But some of the older ISRs, have metal cases, and some of the big ones actually have metal cases, and you do need to electrically ground them. 2. Seat the external compact flash card. That means put it into the slot and slide it in. That doesn't mean sit on it. Sitting on compact flash cards is likely to break them. So put it into the router and make sure that it is firmly installed into the router. 3. Connect the power cable. A very important step. If you don't connect the power cable, the lights are not going to come on. And it's not going to work very much. Now, also, it helps to configure the terminal emulation software on the PC and connect the PC to the console port with the provided console cable. Now, the provided console cable is an RS232 serial port. If you do not have PCs serial ports on your PC, you will need a USB to serial adapter. So probably a good idea to have gone out and bought one before you even started on this, because you will probably need one. Good morning, Saprita. Turn on the router. There we go, step 5, turn on the router. It also goes without saying that the power is also turned on, otherwise the router won't. Observe the startup messages on the PC as the router boots. And in fact, one of the labs that you will be doing when the remote bundle is functional is to reload one of the routers on the remote bundle and look at the startup messages. And in fact, the remote bundle is actually in enough of a state for you to be able to do that, just about. So we'll certainly be playing with that. Okay, any questions so far? All right, let's see. There are three statements. Did that something? There we go. I've got a bizarre sound from my computer, so it's just funny what was going on there. There are three stages when the router boots. Okay, post occurs. Power on self-test, and the router checks hardware and memory. The router then loads the bootstrap program. The bootstrap locates the Cisco iOS, either in flash memory, TFTP server, or from another location, which is configured in your configuration file. The iOS then locates and executes the startup configuration file. The startup configuration file is stored in NVRAM, and I'll talk about the different memory types in a minute, and it's copied to RAM while the router is running. The router boots, and the running config is stored in the memory of the router. Now, there are a number of types of RAM in a Cisco router, or a number of types of memory. There is ROM. Can anybody tell me what ROM stands for?
Read-only memory.
Mm-hmm. And read-only memory is exactly that. The information is burnt onto chips, and generally the only way to erase them is to reflash the chips, reburn the chips, which you erase with ultraviolet light and then reburn. ROM stores the system bootstrap, and it stores a minimal version of iOS. And the minimal version of iOS is usually enough to bootstrap the router and test it and do all sorts of funky things with it. You do that to... you usually have a newer version of iOS installed on the router in another memory location. The only way to change ROM, generally speaking, is to resocket new ROM chips. Now, the next sort of memory that you have in Cisco's is flash memory. Can anybody tell me what is the fundamental difference between ROM and flash memory?
You can reprogram flash.
You can electrically reprogram flash, and Geraldine's going to have to answer her phone in a minute. It's currently playing the Roadrunner theme. That's all right. Flash is usually actually stored on compact flash cards generally these days, although in older Cisco routers such as the 2500s and 2600s that like I've got sitting at home, it's actually stored in a flash SIM. There's actually a little single inline memory module that has flash on it. Okay. The third type of memory is called NVRAM. NVRAM is non-volatile random access memory, and it is battery-backed. It's usually CMOS, which is a low-power memory, and the battery retains the information that is stored in NVRAM. Usually configuration file or files are stored in NVRAM. To give you some idea, you're looking at sort of 8 or 16 megs of ROM. You're looking at, say, 8 megs or 4, 8 or 256 megs of flash, or in some routers even more. And you're looking at NVRAM, which is usually about 32K in size, or sometimes it's bigger than that depending on the router. You can store multiple iOS images in flash at once, and you can tell the router which one it is to boot, depending on what various registers and stuff are set to. Okie dokie. The show version command, which is a version you'll get to execute as part of your labs, shows the Cisco iOS version that you're using, the version of the system bootstrap stored in ROM, the memory that was used that was initially used to boot the router, the complete file name of the Cisco iOS image, and where the bootstrap program actually loaded it from, because it is possible to load, for example, one iOS from flash and one from the network, and you might have pulled the one from the network, or you might have fallen back to the one from flash. The type of CPU on the router and the amount of RAM, and it might be necessary to upgrade the amount of RAM if you're upgrading the iOS software, because iOS software, as in any operating system, has a minimum requirement for RAM and flash storage space. And in fact, if you want to run iOS version 12.1 on the Cisco 2500 series routers, which is the last version you can run, you actually need to have 16 meg of RAM and 16 meg of flash, or 16 meg of RAM, and pull the image over the network at boot time, which means your TFTP server must be up and running all the time if you're going to do that. The number and type of physical interfaces on the router, that's important. The amount of NVRAM, which we've already discussed. The amount of flash memory, which is used to permanently store the Cisco image. You might have to upgrade that too if you're upgrading the iOS, as previously discussed. The current configuration value of the software configuration register, and I think we'll talk about the software configuration register in a minute. It's an interesting little beastie that you do need to set. Now, the value in parentheses is the value that's going to be used at the next reload. The configuration register is used to tell the router all different sorts of things. It tells the router where it's going to find its iOS, in which medium. It's going to tell it where to find its it tells it the baud rate of the console interface. It tells it whether or not it's going to load its configuration file or not. And if you are doing a password recovery on a Cisco router, which you can only do from the console port, you need to set the configuration value to 0x2142. Reload the router and it'll bypass its configuration file. Then you can either erase the configuration file or reset the enable secret so that you can get back into the router again. If the router fails to boot and it cannot find a valid iOS image, it will boot into a thing called ROMON mode, which is basically like this debugger that you can do different things like load iOS images over the network, reflash iOS images. You can also change the value of the configuration register to bypass the configuration file. You can use things like dirflash and bootflash commands to actually pick which iOS you're going to load up from ROMON mode. And one of our students in 2007 actually did manage to erase the flash image out of the router, and we had to teach them how to put it back in again. You also should check the configuration router if the router does boot, the configuration register, sorry. And you also need to check the startup configuration for alternate boot locations in case it's pulling things from a place that you don't expect it to be pulling it from. Okay, any questions so far? We're about to move on to the next section.
No.
Okay, there is inbound management and out-of-band management. Inbound management refers to configuring a device over the network infrastructure that you have. Generally speaking, most home ISRs, such as your Linksys, your Netgears, your D-Links, all that sort of stuff, only support inbound management. Out-of-band management refers to managing a router over the console port or the auxiliary port. And those ports do not carry any network traffic, therefore those ports are considered to be out of band, which can also be abbreviated OOB. Normally you can in-band manage a router with Telnet, SSH or HTTP, or if you are doing out-of-band management, it's generally done with terminal emulation software and some sort of serial connection to the routers. Some routers do actually have USB ports on the back of them, and you can actually run a cable to your PC, and it will come up as a serial port, and you can use that serial port to manage the router. Now, has anyone not used a serial port for something before? Alrighty, so serial ports, all good. And you'll be using a lot of serial ports, you won't be using serial ports when you talk to the remote bundle directly. You'll be using a connection into the remote bundle, Telnet connection into the remote bundle, and you'll then be accessing the serial ports from there with our serial switch. Okay. CLI is the command line interface. It is the way to configure all of the aspects of the router and all functions and settings in the router. CLI is a command line interface. It allows you to type commands and receive the output to those commands on your terminal screen. We need to explain the CLI, or at least a couple of the features of the CLI which you'll be coming across. One of the things you'll find in the CLI is that you are sitting at a prompt, and the prompts vary depending on what you're doing. If you, and we'll come back to the prompts in a moment, the Cisco routers have command completion, which is very handy. If you type question mark as the first character on a line, it will give you all of the commands that you can execute in a list, and then you can start typing one, and you can press tab to complete the rest of the command out if that command is uniquely completable. We suggest that students do get used to type show running-config rather than show space run, because whilst show space run is shorter, it's important that you remember what the commands actually are, not just the abbreviations. If you type in some letters of a command, for example sh, and press question mark, it will actually tell you what commands are possible, and you can type in some more letters to make that command unique. That's sort of step-by-step, context-sensitive help sort of stuff. You can also go show space question mark, and that will show you all of the things that you can put after the show command. You can navigate the history by using the up and down arrows. Also, Control-N and Control-P will take you backwards and forwards in the history. Control-N for next, Control-P for previous. The reason that they use the Emacs-style key bindings is because there are actually terminals that do not have arrow keys. One of the things that you've got to remember when you are telnetting into a device or SSHing into a device is that not all of the keys on your PC keyboard are going to be relevant to the device that you're telnetting into. For example, Linux has no concept of a scroll lock key inside a terminal session. The terminal emulators do not know about scroll lock, for example. Also, don't assume your arrows are going to work, because often they don't, or an application doesn't understand arrow keys. For example, under Linux in the line-based editor ed, your arrows will not move you around the screen. They'll just put a left bracket A, a left bracket B, and various other interesting things into your terminal input buffer. Okay. Now, there is a thing that comes with a router called SDM, which is the Cisco Device Manager. It's used for initial configuration of the router, and it's used for in-band management only, therefore you need a network connection to the router for SDM to function. SDM is good for initial configuration, however it's not particularly accessible if you can't see. If you want to use SDM or you want to try SDM, you will need to have either JAWS and the Java Access Bridge installed, and Java, obviously, or you'll also need WindowEyes and WE for Java, and I'm not sure how well it works. We tend to encourage students to do most of their initial configuration from the command line where possible. Not all commands are supported in SDM. And also keep in mind that a misconfigured device can break your network. SDM Express has 8 screens. The overview screen, basic configuration, LAN IP address, DHCP configuration, internet or the WAN setup, firewall, and security settings. And there's a summary. Okay, you must set up. These are the things you must configure. Host name, domain name, a username, and a password. And also you will need to set the enable secret, which is similar to the administrator password that gives you access to everything, i.e. all of the keys to the city. set the IP address so that when the router restarts, it uses the new IP address, which is hopefully in your network range, rather than the IP address configured in the Quick Start guide. If you tell the router to act as a DHCP server, it leases addresses by default to PCs for one day. If you have a powerful router, you can use it as a DHCP server, but often other people use different DHCP servers, such as Windows Server ones, so that it can integrate into Active Directory and all those sorts of good things. Now, serial links. When we talk serial links here, we are talking about high-speed synchronous links between various points, and they're often used for high bandwidth internet connectivity. An example of a serial link would be a T1. Has anybody heard of a T1? Okay, well, T1 is 1.54 megabits per second, I believe, and then you've got the European standards, so the E1 is a different speed because it uses a different clocking rate. For example, we had Lismore Internet Services when I worked back there. We actually had four Cisco routers handling the in-dial modems, and we had 16 modems per Cisco 2509. We also had a Cisco 2511, which connected Lismore to the rest of the internet, and the rest of the internet was a 2 megabit per second DDS, or digital data service, which was actually a serial connection to Telstra, which is our one of our big bandwidth providers. You need a DCE and a DTE. DCE is data communications equipment, and DTE is data terminal equipment. The DCE on a serial link is the one that sets the clock. The person who sets the clock decides how fast the serial link is going to run. This is generally your internet service provider, unless, of course, you are providing services to other customers, and in that case, you set the clock rate for those other customers. And obviously, you charge them accordingly. The faster the clock rate, the more you charge them. Now, you've got the encapsulation, which is different ways of encapsulating the serial information, such as HDLC and SDLC, and things like ATM, which is asynchronous transfer mode, and PPP is another way of encapsulating the protocols, PPP standing for point-to-point protocol. People will have come in contact with PPPoE if they've been dealing with ADSL connections, which is PPP over Ethernet, or you can also come into contact with PPPoA, which is PPP over ATM connection, which allows you to also connect to your internet service provider. It depends on what the equipment at the other end of your link supports as to what you are going to configure. In Australia, for example, you generally use PPPoE with a VPI of 8 and a VCI of 35. VCI and VPI of 8.35, and they are two parameters that are set depending on where you are in the world and what the other end's equipment expects. Okay, there are a number of ways of assigning an IP address over a serial link. You can either have an unnumbered interface, which means it doesn't actually have an IP address assigned to it. It just gets the packets and receives them. You can assign them using PPP, such as with the LCP protocol, which is the link control protocol for PPP. There's also EZIP, which I think is a Cisco standard, and static, which means that the addresses are set manually by the administrator. Any questions on all that so far? Yet. And you can come back and ask them later, if you have them, obviously.
No, I think I'll
let you know. Yeah, there's a lot in here. SDM is able to configure the network address translation settings in your router. Also keep in mind, though, that it does make a lot more sense once you're actually playing on the routers. In Discovery 2 and stuff, practical experience is very, very important. And, in fact, that will make the difference between passing and failing the Discovery. SDM configures the network address translation layer, although you can configure it from the CLI, although it is a little bit complex to do so, although we will have students doing that when you get to the labs. Okay, there are two modes in CLI. There's the user mode, which usually has a prompt of greater than, or a left-facing crocodile, as we tend to call them. In other words, the open bit to the left is a greater than, and the open bit to the right is a less than. Yeah, that's right. The greater than symbol denotes user exec mode, and generally users in user exec mode can look at status of the router and stuff, but they can't actually change the configuration of the router. Now, privileged exec mode is the super user mode of the router, and the prompt changes to a hash mark, number sign, noughts and crosses, octothorpe, whatever you want to call it. In other words, shift 3 if you're on a US keyboard, which ironically enough I think becomes pounds if you're on a UK keyboard, but that's neither here nor there. So you want the number sign. There are different prompts that you can have if you're in different modes. So if you if your router is called Snoopy, your user exec mode is Snoopy Greater. Your privileged exec mode prompt is Snoopy Number. If you go into router configuration mode, or global configuration mode with config T from privileged exec mode, your prompt then becomes Snoopy dash config number. If you are configuring an interface, it becomes Snoopy config dash IF number. So as you can see, the prompt changes depending on what you're doing, and it's very important to pay attention to the prompt to find out what mode you think you're in, what you're actually in, and also in complicated network environments that you are actually working on the right router. That always helps. Okay, now global configuration mode allows you to set global settings of the router, such as its host name, its time servers, its name servers, its default gateway, the time zone, prompts, login banners, login messages, that sort of thing. Now, router configuration mode allows you to set up the different routing protocols, such as RIP, BGP, OSPF, all that sort of stuff. And then there is interface configuration mode, which allows you to configure the various interfaces, such as their encapsulation, their IP address, their subnet mask, all those sorts of things you can configure in interface configuration mode. We've already discussed the help command. The history command allows you to change various aspects of the command history as to how many history commands are stored, and that sort of thing. I would recommend that anybody who wants to look at any of the Cisco commands grab themselves a copy of the Ciscopedia, which is up on the QCAT website, install that, and it is a Windows help file that contains information on all sorts of Cisco commands, and it can be a very good reference when you are undertaking your labs. If you mistype a command or you mess up a command and there's an error, the caret will show you where the iOS thinks the error is on the command line. And that can be a bit tricky with JAWS because you've got to figure out where the caret lines up with the line above it. So you might want to avail yourself of Jackie's read single character when you go down by one rather than reading whole word scripts, which will go up into the extras area soon. The show commands allow you to display all sorts of information on the router. So, for example, you can show running-config, you can show startup-config, you can show IP interfaces, you can show network address translation parameters and translations, you can show routing information and routing tables. Show IP route, for example, is a command that you can use. And there are all sorts of different show commands that will show you different things about the router. Any questions so far on any of the things I've said so far, apart from needing to read through the notes, quite understandably? Okay, no problem. You have an enable password and you have an enable secret. The enable password is usually stored in plain text in the router unless you use service password - encryption. If you, however, use the enable secret, it is usually encrypted with quite a strong cipher. The cipher that encrypts the passwords in service password encryption is a weak cipher, and it's just meant to see stop people from viewing passwords inside of configuration files. The banner messages of the day and the banner login are the two banners that are displayed. The login one is displayed on login to the router, and you should probably have a message in there saying that unauthorized access to this router is prohibited. And a lot of ISPs have a summary of which laws you will probably be hit with if you break into that router or try logging into that router in an unauthorized way. And then the banner login is the one that is displayed when you log in. That's usually used to display messages that are going to be important to all administrators or users that are actually logging into that router, such as planned downtime and stuff. You do not show that at login, because if you show it at login, it'll tell all the hackers when you're going to have your downtimes and stuff, and you probably don't want that. Synchronous logging is a setting that allows log messages to be sent to the console straight away. This can be very disruptive, however, because log messages will scroll onto your screen while you're in the middle of typing commands, and it can be very difficult to actually see what commands you're typing when the log messages are yabbering at you all the time. So you can actually decide whether to set synchronous logging on or not. If you mistype a command in the CLI and mistype the first word, the router will try and resolve the mistyped command as a hostname. If you have DNS servers that are inaccessible or unavailable, it can take a long time for that failed DNS lookup query to work. So if you type shot instead of show, it will try and look up a system called shot and open a telnet connection to it, which probably isn't what you wanted. It's important then to go into global configuration mode, which you do by going config space T in privileged execution mode, and then run no IP domain - lookup, which will stop it from looking up those names in the DNS. You want console access from the PC whenever that's possible. And there's also what we call VTY network access, which actually comes in on VTY ports 0 through 4. And that is where you telnet or SSH into the router, therefore, which is in-band management. The interfaces on the router are named with the controller and the interface number. So, for example, your first fast Ethernet port might be called fast Ethernet space 0/0, or fast Ethernet 0/1, or fast Ethernet 0/2, which refers to the first, second, and third controllers on the first Ethernet set of sub-interfaces, obviously. If you don't configure the default route, you won't be able to get traffic out to the internet, so it's important that you configure the default route on your router when you are doing the initial configuration. It is possible to configure the DHCP server with a CLI. You can actually look up how to do that in the Ciscopedia, or we will possibly come up with some notes and provide those. Now, when you're setting up network address translation, you need to know which interface is your inside interface and which is your outside interface. Generally speaking, your inside interface will be the fast Ethernet switch that is on the router, and the outside interface will be your network internet-facing PPP interface or similar. If you execute show net translations, it will actually show you what connections are running through the router at any given time. Any questions? Well, that is the end of Discovery 2 Module 5, and I expect lots of questions once the remote bundle is operational and students start working on the labs and stuff, which should happen in the next couple of weeks or so. So we'll be available on Skype. If you've got any questions, feel free to ask. Otherwise, enjoy the rest of your day.
Bye for now, everyone.
See you guys later.